to that movement in Europe, would the German government show some strengths and capacities that some would say they fear they did not show in earlier historical periods? Would Germany be capable of exercising power with the kind of restraint and responsibility that you have shown so well in the post-war period, but not necessarily in the same manner in the Hitler period?
Well, let me try to answer. First of all, I think that as far as the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe is concerned, the development in countries like Poland and Czechoslovakia, Hungary, etc., is irreversible. It really is irreversible. Maybe the situation, the picture is not quite as clear in Romania and Bulgaria, but still I think it's irreversible in those countries as well. But I'm not so sure about that. In the Soviet Union, of course, many things can happen. But I think one thing cannot happen. They cannot come back to the old structures, the old ideas, the old policies. And they cannot do it because they cannot economically, they cannot afford it. I think it's not by chance that Ligachev was always depicted as the hardliner and the big adversary of Gorbachev. That a man like Ligachev is obviously a reformer, only he is more cautious than Gorbachev. He wants to go much slower, and he is afraid that Gorbachev's way to do it may blow the whole thing up. And personally, I prefer Gorbachev by far, but Ligachev, I never understood this man whose speeches I used to read as far as they are available. I never considered that man a Stalinist. I think Stalinism is out, and I guess even Leninism is out, and whatever happens, and there can be setbacks, it will not be the old thing again. And they will have to concentrate on domestic issues for decades to come. Secondly, as far as we are concerned, we could not anymore for ourselves autonomously exercise any role of power. My understanding of your question was what you meant was in the last analysis military power, but because the economic thing is quite a different thing. It can never lead to war. It can never pose any real threat. Militarily, we cannot be a great power anymore for physical reasons. I am personally convinced that we are not going to be a military great power for other reasons as well, psychological reasons. But I know the old debate in arms control, do you rely on intentions or capabilities? And so I know all that I have learned for years. And even if I take capabilities only, we couldn't. It would be impossible for physical reasons. So the question in the last analysis is, would the integrated West be able to react the right way? And I think the integrated West would be able to react the right way. And let me add at this point, I should have said so before maybe, but your question gives me the occasion. Let me say at this point, I think most of my countrymen think that the President Bush has handled this whole development in Eastern Europe since fall last year very well indeed. And as far as we are Germans are concerned, I should like to add that he has managed to act as a friend of our nation without antagonizing the Russians at the same time. Because that would be the worst thing. I mean, nobody could be interested in antagonizing the Russians. And the President, I think, has has, how do you say, traded this path,
a narrow path?
Traded this narrow path exceedingly well.
Mrs. Merchant.
Is it true that outside of West and East Germany, there are still millions of ethnic Germans in the Soviet Union, in Romania, in Hungary, who perhaps will want to come back to the fatherland? I thought I read that more of them have already entered West Germany than the number of East Germans who have entered.
Yeah, last year it was about 350,000 from each of these two groups, so altogether 700,000, which in proportion would amount to about 3 million in your country. Our guess is that there are still about 2 million in the Soviet Union, maybe half a million, maybe somewhat more. In Poland, about 250,000 in Romania, and about 200,000 in Hungary, but they want to stay. The Hungarians have always treated them without any discrimination, and the ethnic group in Hungary never wanted to leave. The others may leave over the years. We try to persuade the host government to create conditions which motivate these people to stay, because we are a very narrow country. We have no interest. Why shouldn't the Germans in the Soviet Union stay in the Soviet Union if conditions were acceptable? But that's exactly the problem. I mean, the Soviet Union is in deep economic trouble, Poland is in trouble, and there is a strong movement there, and I think this year we'll again have between 750,000 and 1 million new citizens, and it becomes a problem.
Paul Drexler. There's
some speculation about
the
papers in the United Germany relocate their capital.
Well, I think it's unavoidable. It's interesting. A discussion begins about this. And somebody who spoke out yesterday or before yesterday against Berlin as new capital and in the favor of Bonn as the capital of a united Germany was the Secretary General of the Social Democratic Party, Mrs. Fuchs. Now, Mrs. Fuchs is from Hamburg. And the Hamburgers always had were somewhat suspicious. They didn't like the Prussians. They didn't like Berlin too much. Hamburg, when the Second Empire was founded in 1870, Hamburg refused for 10 years to join the customs union. Hamburg became a member of the empire, but not of the customs union. It joined only 10 years later. So they always had their own ideas. And that's good. So, I mean, we are a federation, as you are, and we have much understanding for statehood. But Berlin will be the capital. That will be the view of the vast majority. I'm sure about 70%. If you would take a poll today, 70% of the people in East and West would opt for Berlin.
Anyone in the outer office, Ambassador Watson or Whittle Johnson, or any of you care to ask questions? Yes. Tom? Come.
Are you calling on me? Yes, I had this question. The mechanics of integrating these things are of interest. In the GDR, as you know, they abolished the old Linda and created these 14 or 15 administrative units. Now, it seems to me to bring the GDR back into the West in the existing parliamentary structure, somehow you have to recreate Linda in there proportionate to the Linda in the West, so you have the representation in the Bundestag is in line with the population and the geographical units. How will that be done? Everybody sit down at a map and redraw some lines and make a DPA Saxony and Brandenburg and Mecklenburg. Mechanically, how will all that come about, do you think?
Well, as far as it is a legal question, it could be done very quickly. I mean, the reshaping of the administration itself, of course, will take more time. But my guess is that exactly this is going to happen very quickly after the elections. They will restore the old Länder, which, after all, have a very long tradition. In particular, Saxony and Mecklenburg have very old tradition. And the little piece of Prussia which is left over and which is now would be the land of Brandenburg. As you know, Prussia was Brandenburg until the beginning of the 18th century. The name was Brandenburg and it was a small duchy. And it will be a small duchy again and the name will again be Brandenburg. So these Länder will be restored and Berlin, including, we will probably have no capital district as you have, but a land state, Berlin. So there would be six, and the population is 16 for the DDR and 2 for West Berlin, so 18. It would be, on average, it would be Länder with 3 million people, comparable to the smaller Länder in the West. But population-wise, smaller, geographically speaking, larger than most of the Western Länder, because the density of population in the East is about half what it is in the West.
Secretary Armitage. Let me come back to Mrs. Merchant's question and to the Polish border question. It seems to me the two are pretty closely related. You spoke of the brethren, the German brethren that reside in East Germany. In a sense, the Silesian population is really no less brotherly. So the border question is not a question of drawing lines, but what's going to happen to rather substantial emotional problems on the one hand of Germans wanting to be sure that their brethren in Silesia, Poland, are well treated, and on the other hand, handling the rather deep-seated and not without expression politically apprehensions of the Poles. But the border question has to be resolved, we can all agree. I'm just wondering if Chancellor Kohl won't feel impelled to ask from the Poles a commitment on the basic human rights, including representation, education in Germany, in German, and non-discrimination in employment, the kind of things that would make life more livable, as Mrs. Merchant was raising the question, for the German, ethnic Germans that are in Poland, as his quid pro quo for a final settlement of the border problem. And I'm wondering how difficult you think some such provisions would be to negotiate with the Poles.
Well, actually you raised two different issues, and one is simple, the other is extremely complicated. The simple issue, I think, is to create conditions under which these people would be willing to stay in Poland. This is well underway. We have already first understandings with the Poles. They are again permitted to teach German to have German schools. It went even so far that at a time that the Catholic Church did not permit services in German. And that was not a decision of the party or the state, it was a decision of the church. And they did not permit German services. In the meantime, they have reached an understanding with the German Episcopate, and now all this is beginning, and I think we will probably reach a solution which is satisfactory to the local ethnic group. The second part of your question is very difficult. That is the question, should one link the final final confirmation of the acceptance of the Polish western border with any other conditions? And I really cannot tell you what the Chancellor may have in mind or the Foreign Minister may have in mind. They have never been talking about it. But of course I would be happy if at the moment this is definitely signed and ratified, that at that moment all claims are considered regulated. It would not be good if after the signing of such a treaty we would then be confronted with new claims for compensation or reparation, what have you. That would, I think, create a kind of frustration, and probably on both sides. But whether one should link it formally to each other, that's a different question. I think we have to settle, we have to have the definite settlement of the Polish border very fast. It should not be held up by complicated negotiations about other questions. It should, because if once you do that, then, I mean, the whole, then you shift the whole thing. Then it is not any more a kind of unconditional acceptance of this border, which after all has existed for 40 years, but then it becomes conditional. And you say, well, if I do not get this, then I'm not going to give that. I think we should get over with it. And my advice, if it was my duty to advise the Chancellor, would be to sign and ratify as fast as possible, but to express the hope, and very strongly so, that this settles everything and that it's over.
Other questions? Yes. The question is, we'd like to know your views on signing a peace treaty with a general peace treaty.
There has never been a peace treaty.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have been living quite happily without, not necessarily happily, but we got accustomed to it. And you can have, as we have seen, you can, fortunately enough, you can have peace even without a peace treaty. So whether a peace treaty is the ideal solution, whether it's really useful and wise to begin to negotiate a peace treaty after 45 years, I don't know. What we need is a settlement, a final settlement. And I think the idea to work something like a final settlement out within the framework of the Helsinki process, of this conference of 33 European states, including as the 34th and 35th, the United States and Canada, I think that is a better concept. It's a concept which I think would permit us to focus on what is really essential, the border issue and questions like that, and not lead into endless negotiations about all kinds of other questions which are normally regulated in a peace treaty. So I hope that the consultations between ourselves and then with the four powers and then at the same in a parallel way with NATO and the European Community and finally at a Helsinki summit will result in a settlement which puts an end to all these debates once and for all, and not result in negotiations which could last years and years.
Any other questions? Yeah, Victor Yonke.
Mr. Ambassador, are there any people in the political party of former Chancellor Schmidt, any people in this party who would be intellectually and experienced that he was? He was considered a great person.
Yeah.
The Chancellor Kohler did not be elected. If there was someone in the other party who would serve the country well.
Yeah, well, if the Chancellor Kohl is not in the Federal Republic, he will be re-elected, but I guess. But in elections for the whole of the country, his chances are not as good, because, as it seems, presently the Social Democratic Party would get over 50% of the vote in what is presently the DDR. So there would be a certain shift, and we are talking about very little margins anyway, very small margins anyway. In case of a social democratic victory, the chancellor would be Mr. Lafontaine from the SAR, and we can't say he has never held office on the level of the federation. You have had cases when presidents came in who never had office on the level of the federal government.
That's the rule rather than the exception. Maybe.
I wanted to state a fact, and the fact is that in such a case, it's not easy to predict how this man then would act on the federal level, because you just don't know. If he has been a legislator in the Senate, for instance, for decades, you know. Otherwise, you don't. And that is the situation with Mr. Lafontaine. He's a state governor, in your terms, and we just don't know. What we know is he's very intelligent. No doubt about that. He has been a very successful state governor, and he has one characteristic which maybe is not traditionally, at least not German, he loves good food.
Any other question? We've gone a little longer than we usually do, even in the middle of the week, and I know many of you have other things. I had one thought in conclusion. If Mr. Kissinger had been in this audience, I wonder if at the beginning he had not felt complimented about being associated with you, wouldn't he in the end have been very pleased?
Inside, they may be quieter, they may be more indirect, they can be very helpful. change, which, let's say, you don't have in Poland, where you have a miserable economic situation, where the prescription that you set up for Chile might be not at all applicable to a country with a disastrous financial situation. Argentina is another, where your transition is entirely different, and in that basis, taking that point of view, maybe the most important element is this nationalism, which I hadn't thought of before, and the economic.
You want just a one sentence summary? We have complaints that you can't hear the question from the outside. Could you hear it enough?
Yeah, that was okay.
All right.
Let me make perhaps two comments. I have trouble myself, I think, allowing for the uniqueness of almost every situation to try to apply the recipes or the lessons too automatically to other countries, as you know. In the Chilean situation, I find it hard to say for sure that one factor is more important than another. But second comment, without question, what does distinguish the Chilean situation from many others I know, is exactly what you pointed out. That is, this new government is going to be inheriting a significantly better situation than you can imagine most governments. Admittedly, there have been some elements in the present government, and I tend, once describing all the evil of Pinochet, I tend to think this is part of the Pinochet syndrome. There has been some attempts to try to complicate matters for the new government in terms of economic management. I heard one report yesterday, like ministries speeding up their expenditures in order to run down the amounts available for the rest of the fiscal year. On the nationalism question, just as a parenthesis there, I think that fits in with what I was trying to call a civic or a democratic culture, a sense of responsibility to the country that is strong. And I'm interested in that example. It does fit with some of my own experience, though, the way children feel about their country.
George Woods put us in the arena years ago. He was, began at the very bottom, went to the top of the World Bank, first in the private sector, then the World Bank. And his thesis was it ought to be easier for technical assistance agencies to work in
possibly because, as I mentioned earlier, about 1981, the Communist Party decided that violence was the way to achieve their ends. And also, I indicated that we had some reports indicating that at least some of the violent parts of the party were prepared to try to create trouble in the plebiscite. And certainly, the Democratic opposition and the church, for that matter, all worked to try to reduce that possibility. There are elements connected to what's called an unwelcome. At least as far as I know, I've still not been convinced that this sort of transition is the way to secure the sort of order that we'd like to propose. And yet, it's been very clear to me, certainly, and in a more chilling point, importantly, that the national mood is not one for extremes. Still, as in other societies, that a small, dedicated group could try shooting policemen under the new government the way they tried shooting and shot policemen under the current government. One of the things I've noted is that the president-elect has asked the chief of national police to stand and he's accepted. That's in good part because he's done a lot over the last 3 years or so, four, that he's been in office to try to refurbish, revive the reputation of the Carabineros as protectors of the law and not as instruments of the repressive government. And so sympathy with him and his efforts, and also sympathy with the Carabineros for what pressure they've been subject to. So to the extent that popular support can make a difference and make it less likely that the radical groups will be able to get in, I think there's a fairly good prospect. I would have to say that I worry simply because of the ability of small groups to make
pressure. I wonder, sir, if you could speculate for us on the degree to which the Chileans have now overcome, through their pragmatism or some range ahead, the tendency to move to ideological factionalism and squabbling, which so dominated so many decades of their politics before. And also, would you, for our curiosity's sake, answer whether the death of Allende was murder or suicide?
Let me start with the second question first. You're giving me credit for much more knowledge than I have. I take from what I've read and the people I've talked to, I take it from suicide. I find very convincing, for example, the argumentation in a book written by one of my predecessors, Matt Davis, who was there at the time, which examines a number of theories. And beyond that, talking to Chileans who knew Allende, it seems to me that that's by far the more probable explanation. The constitution I mentioned had been amended in this last year after the plebiscite. One of the amendments was to provide for a 4-year term of office for this new president instead of being an 8-year term. That was done, I think, again, part out of pragmatic reasons, a recognition that Chileans do like to debate, they do like to argue, and they like to organize to support their arguments, and therefore to expect a new president to manage for 8 whole years seemed like really much. So I think it's a recognition of the fact that there's going to be, if not politics as usual, it's going to be a lot of politics, and that this 4-year period ought to be a period of transition to ease the return to a still more open nothing said that. I have, so far anyway. I'm going back next month for a couple of days of time in moderation. Watching with some fresh impressions. I still have a feeling of a lot of faith that the trauma of Allende, the trauma of Pinochet, is so great, particularly on the older generation. We're still prominent and we're getting for about how much in politics. And the implications of the Pinochet regime on the younger generation, that there's going to be a certain restraint, a certain break on going too far. I mentioned the area of economic policy right now. That's a policy, this approach, which is supported by a number of people who were supporters of Allende and various factions of the socialist party, who began to pull themselves together because they recognize they can't have several socialist parties and do their own long-term policy any good. As a recognition on their part of the importance, for example, of the private sector. And so, if they were to make changes, I would not expect even the socialists would make very dramatic changes as such. One of the ironies, going back to the economic question, one of the ironies of the plebiscites, I think it's probably accurate to say that Pinochet got as many votes as he did, in good part because of the economic policies associated with his government, but also lost a substantial number of votes because of the same policies, depending on who would benefit and who wasn't. So I end up at this point anyway, even before the government has taken office, being relatively optimistic that Chileans have learned and will not easily forget what they've
learned. Ambassador Watson, and then the approach.
I would like to congratulate the Ambassador again on the whole perception of lucid and illuminating. About the sense that
certainly the military I got to know put a lot of stress on the sacrifices they had made in saving the country. And in their advocacy of what Pinochet called a protected democracy, argued that that made sense because they wanted to avoid a future situation where they had to intervene again. But this was implicitly a reaffirmation of the obligation to intervene if things got bad. Still, my overall conclusion, and I gave an example so earlier, my overall conclusion is that still stronger is the feeling that politics is not their business. What they have attempted to do in the new law on the armed forces is to strike something of a balance in anticipation of avoiding a future intervention, namely to give them some of the way of prerogatives and protection of their promotion systems and this sort of thing, and also to set up an advisory council for the new president so he can hear about military concerns. But at the same time, not to go so far as Pinochet wanted to go, I think if the politicians are as smart as I know most of them are, can be, and recognize the need for this sort of understanding of the military's sense of responsibility for internal life of the country, they're going to pay more attention to them than they traditionally did, say, in the 1950s or 1960s. Let me just add a quick footnote since you met Senator Teitelbaum. He's credited with having added rather significantly to Pinochet's vote count in October 1988 because he came back from exile. The exile had been abolished just before the plebiscite and made sort of an unreconstructed Stalin's type speech, which scared a lot of people. Thought, this is the beginning of the end again. And whether it was 50,000 votes or 100,000 votes or hard to tell. Gets credit for that. He's shut up since then.
Bill Workman. I think we've heard of the difficult navigation of American presence in South and Central America. Your role is that
essentially what we worked out, that form for our winter Santiago, was a threefold policy. One, to continue to be supportive of the macroeconomic policies. At the same time, though, to be quite clear that we thought basic human rights needed to be respected much more than they were being respected in Chile. Secondly, that we thought there was every reason for Chile to move as promptly as possible, and preferably through discussions among the parties, namely government and the opposition, move toward a return to democracy. That Chile wasn't the sort of country that needed much in the way of lessons in democracy. It ought to be able to resume democratic style fairly quickly. In that attempt to be clear and reasonably consistent involved me in a variety of things, and involved us in a variety of things, and to give an example. For reasons I still do not understand to this day, the foreign ministry, I'm not sure whether this was Chen Bob or not, the foreign ministry found it very difficult to arrange my initial appointment once I'd seen the foreign minister, once I'd seen my credentials. And I had planned to make sort of the round of official calls and then start on the non-official calls. So I decided, you know, why sit around my office? I might as well go see some of the people I could see without having to wait for the foreign ministry to make the arrangements. So I started getting acquainted with some of the people in the political parties, the opposition political parties. And the fact that I, as the ambassador of the United States, went to see them instead of summoning them to see me, apparently struck Chileans as interesting and unexpected. It struck the government as more than that. And it did help speed up some of my government appointments at the same time as well. Also, I started getting acquainted with some of the human rights organizations. I went to a service at the cathedral in commemoration of a declaration by a number of church groups in the mid-70s on the importance of human rights. It was a candlelight service. Cameras were there as well, and it was covered fairly prominently. One of the papers the next day had a cartoon showing me with a candle in my hand and then showing obviously a terrorist. There is a certain way to recognize terrorists in Chile. A ski cap, you know, just the portion of the eyes open, and then sort of a light jacket. So here was the terrorist with a bomb in hand, here was I with a candle in hand. More formally, at the next session of the Human Rights Commission in Geneva in the spring of 1986, for the first time in the Reagan administration, we sponsored a resolution on Chile and human rights, which got the consensus backing, quite critical.
you think the Catholic Church opposed Pinochet, whereas they had pretty well gone along with the communist, atheistic Allende?
I guess I would say there are two reasons. Although not having been there in the Allende period, I don't have any direct sense. Admittedly, my sense of Pinochet is toward the end, too. I think that, from what I'm told, the church was beginning to have more and more qualms about Allende. And some people have argued, and no way to verify this, as I say, some people argue that if Allende had continued, some of those questions would have become much more public than they did. Second, I think, was the role played by Cardinal Cipro, who was not so affectionately named by detractors or sympathizers of his as the Red Cardinal. He had become cardinal a couple of years before, and by 1973 had begun to sort of chalk out, I think, his own sense of where he wanted the church to kind of go in Chile, and suddenly was confronted with this extraordinary situation. And I think it was his own strong convictions, not so much following the cardinal, not so much on the question of Allende or not, but his own strong convictions on the importance of human rights of that in this direction. He's the sort of person that, as I say, some people say, who moved a little more slowly than Allende period that had continued. That's the only guess I can make. I'm told he hesitated for a while in the fall of 1973 after the takeover because he recognized the amount of support that the military had from many children for very drastic involvement. But that then, based on what was happening, particularly the disappearance of disciples of the church,
I think what we've heard is add to the breadth of our thinking about every other discussion we have in this series, because on one hand we've been invited to think hard about the benefits of the kind of free market development that occurred in Chile, but on the other hand it's possibly a further lesson that may have escaped some of us that a rather conservative administration, second half of the Reagan administration, was in the forefront where it had good representation in the area promoting democracy as well, and how these things are balanced and how they relate to one another and what kind of a broad constituency can support them here as well as in the country concerned is one of the unanswered questions that I suppose in American foreign policy. So not only has Ambassador Barnes given us a most lucid account of the history and development of Chile, but he also has posed the enduring issues that we face of how both support free market developments and democracy in the country where the United States has interest. Thank you very much.
No, but I knew a guy, but I knew a guy that priest rather well, and I worked with him, and I remember having been in the